This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Cedarside.com, your all-natural, organic solution to pest control problems, protecting people, pets, and premises. Cedarside.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and time flies because, once again, it just seems like yesterday, it's time again for our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla Mudin is our Hoffman Center nutritionist, and together each week we endeavor to answer your questions. And how are you doing, Layla?
Okay. You know, it does seem like it was just yesterday.
I know. It's just like, I mean, it's just the weeks are...
the week flew.
The weeks are just galloping by. Oh, my goodness.
They are.
So, all right. And we're here in New York experiencing refreshing fall weather. It's been a gorgeous week. And a little rain yesterday, but then beautiful, cool fall weather. And mercifully, I don't know, I think we may have had just a few 90-degree days. We really escaped the worst of it this summer.
We really did, but... let's see what happens this winter.
that's right. I mean, who knows? God only knows. You know, frogs, hail, you know, whatever. All the 10 plagues may be unleashed upon us. All right. So without further ado, by the way, Layla Mudin is a registered dietitian. She also has earned an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition. And she writes a weekly column in our newsletter, which you can sign up for at drhoffman.com. What'd you write about this week, Layla?
I wrote about recovery after exercise.
Oh, great.
Yeah, all about rehydrating and nutrients and branched-chain amino acids and how to do it the right way and so forth. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, so just anecdotally, I didn't know we were going to talk about this, but this morning I worked out with my personal trainer. And then on Wednesdays, they have this really nice outdoor market near me. It comes to our neighborhood once a week. And I got a bunch of, they still have fresh raspberries and fresh strawberries. I don't know where you get strawberries in the month of September, but they grow locally further up north. And so I grabbed some of those after I worked out, and I mixed them with some of that great thorn protein. It's whey protein isolate, which we actually talk about in a podcast that I did a couple of weeks ago, as a great source of protein for post-exercise. And I threw in some a generous dollop of coconut oil, some ice, and a little bit of sour grapes. It's sour cherry group. What is it? Bitter sour? Tart is the term. Yeah, it's tart cherry juice, which is actually something
good for
that's
uric acid. Yeah.
It's good for uric acid, but it's also something that's been shown to alleviate muscle soreness and fatigue. So I thought
really?
That was a really
wonderful.
Yeah, it's actually a nice post exercise cocktail. I just didn't, I didn't have that much time to prepare an elaborate breakfast. Usually, I prefer to eat real food, but I thought I'd have a quick shake, and then that lasted me for a couple hours. Then I went and had lunch. So
that sounds delicious.
Yeah. So, but the fresh fruit really made it because it's just organic produce, just freshly picked, and that was great.
So
you'll talk about it more in your newsletter article.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
All right. This week I wrote about. I'm gonna tease to the article that I wrote this week, and even if you don't subscribe to the newsletter, it will appear at drhoffman.com. If you want to hunt it down, probably will appear by the weekend. My subject is when it comes to your appetite, who's in charge, you or your internal bugs, the bugs inside you, the bugs that outnumber ourselves 10 to 1 in our intestinal tracts. And I just wrote about some of the evidence that we actually can get hijacked in terms of our cravings by the bugs that inhabit our gastrointestinal tracts. So that should be an interesting article.
That is interesting, because we've known, for instance, just to give an example of that, people who have too much candida overgrowth often crave sugar because the candida is craving the sugar.
You know, I'm glad you say that because I actually cite that as example in my article. And I got to tell you, you know, I have a straight academic science background. And when I first heard patients say that, I kept quiet. I didn't want to say, you know, you're full of it. Well, that's kind of a double entendre there. You're full of it. You're full of candida. But, you know, I sort of said, you know, maybe that's just the patient's way of excusing themselves because they have inordinate cravings and lack of self-control. But actually, that's what this article suggests. And there's a lot of science that is now being written about this, about the, it's called the microbiome gut-brain axis. And your gut, with the microbiome, the bugs that inhabit it, may have certain influences on your brain. And guess what yeast needs for its survival? It needs sugar, and it needs fermentable carbohydrates. And it just may be that through some process of survival of the fittest, an evolutionary adaptation, that the yeast or harmful bacteria may signal the brain to crave the kind of junk food that isn't necessarily good for you, but that sustains it. And that's just a fascinating area. So we're exploring that. And it kind of makes you think about, you know, these alien abduction movies, you know, where like alien mind control, you know, they come to Earth, they invade our brains, they latch onto our spinal cords and take over our willpower. And we end up serving the aliens instead of ourselves. So anyway,
And not to make it sound all that scary either, but there is some control that we have, even though the microbiota live inside of us, more of them than there are human cells of our body. But, you know, we do have some control in that what we choose to eat determines which microbiota live or die.
We can turn it around. In other words, it's not just...
We can turn it around,
We can reestablish control because we have brains and they don't. So that's the one advantage we have is that we actually have consciousness and brains and intelligence, and maybe we can sometimes use that.
Hopefully most of us do, yes.
Yeah, but when those cravings come up, man, it's tough. You know, they just overwhelm.
They can be,
They overwhelm your rational brain. All right, so let's move on to questions. What do we have this week?
We have a question here from, I'm not catching the name here, but it's an email we got along with a study from nutritionfacts.org, why the egg cancer link. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the question is, can we help clear up the confusion on eggs? Why is there a cancer link?
Well, first of all, I'm not even sure there is a cancer link because, you know, I think that they've done epidemiological studies where they look at consumption of eggs vis-a-vis cardiovascular disease. Now, the eggs were stigmatized because they thought, well, this is the most concentrated source of cholesterol. Of course, cholesterol is associated with cardiovascular disease, and the cholesterol in the eggs, they say, was going to glom onto your arteries and clog your arteries. And then they did studies that showed that when people consume lots of eggs, that it doesn't usually increase the risk of cardiovascular disease as a whole. I mean, there may be some people with certain genetic variants of very high cholesterol that maybe eggs could be a problem, but that's rare. And for the vast majority of people, it doesn't. It's not associated with cardiovascular disease. And I'm not sure there are any studies that show definitively that egg consumption increases cancer risk. There may be one or two studies that associate it with ovarian cancer, if I'm not mistaken. That may be where some of that comes from. But these studies are notoriously they're inconclusive because one study says yes and the other study says no. When they repeat the study, they get diametrically opposed results. So I'm not entirely sure there's an egg connection. So what this is about something called TMAO. Mm-hmm. And if you... if you're like one of these kids who texts, you know, they abbreviate everything.
Yeah.
A popular text is LMAO, you know, which I'm not going to spell out for people, but it's laughed my something off. But this is TMAO, and it stands for trimethylamine oxidase. And this appears to be a chemical that builds up in the bloodstream that is associated with cardiovascular disease. And now they say, there's the new think, is that it may be associated with cancer. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the precursors for TMAO are lecithin, which is present in eggs and present in soy, and also, you know, phosphatidylcholine, which is choline is a precursor, and so
acetylcholine, sure,
and choline is also something that's present to a high degree in fish. So here's the paradox: how come studies show that people who consume a lot of fish have a lower risk of cardiovascular disease, and probably most studies suggest they have a lower risk of cancer? And similarly, soy is generally not associated with a higher risk of heart disease or cancer, generally lower risk. So this is nice in a test tube model, in a theoretical model. But
here's, not in vivo. Yeah.
Not in vivo, not in mice. And here's the key, is that it appears that your intestinal flora, we keep coming back to what's happening inside the gut. It just governs so many different things. That if you have the wrong flora, the wrong bacteria, that bacteria creates a harmful transformation of the choline to TMAO. And so what they're saying is not stop eating fish and stop eating healthy soy. I mean, I know soy's got, there's a plus and minus on soy too, and that's a whole different argument.
Yeah. But we need choline.
We need to transform our intestinal bacteria. And some of the guys who wrote this article didn't call for the abandonment of intake of choline. What they called for is that, I mean, look, they're traditional scientists, so their perspective is, let's come up with antibiotics that get rid of the bad bacteria. That's, you know, like drug development pathway. And instead of that, I would suggest that people consider probiotics and prebiotics and various herbal methods of suppressing harmful growth of bad bacteria and avoidance of antibiotics, which disrupt the intestinal flora, and avoidance of acid-blocking medication, which disrupt the intestinal flora, encourage breastfeeding, which transfers beneficial bacteria to the intestine, encourage natural childbirth instead of C-section, because you get a whole different set of flora when you pass through the vaginal birth canal, as opposed to when you pop out of an incision in your abdomen. And let's encourage home birth so that people don't pick up hospital germs at birth instead of, you know. So, I mean, it's a culture thing, not just a, you know.
And speaking of culture, fermented food.
Big time. Yeah, thank you.
To repopulate good microbiota.
Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because that's, you've developed sort of a subspecialty within the practice. When I tell people who have disordered gut bacteria, I say, look, you should have cultured food. And then I say, go see Layla. I just don't have time
There's always a jar of kimchi in my refrigerator.
Right. Well, explain what to our listeners. I mean, we live in New York City, and we're just blocks away from the Korean district. So we in New York City, we know precisely what kimchi is. But there's some people who may be listening to us who are in Des Moines, Iowa, or I mean, for all I know, there might be a lot of Koreans in Des Moines. But what is kimchi, and what are some of the cultured foods that you would recommend to people?
Is like an Asian sauerkraut, really. It's made from either bok choy or savoy cabbage, and it's fermented, which then produces a lot of beneficial bacteria. When you open the jar, it bubbles and it speaks to you. It's supposed to do that. Those are the live cultures in there. And it's very beneficial for the GI tract. Kimchi, good quality sauerkraut. I'm talking about the sauerkraut that's just fermented cabbage.
It's not pasteurized. It's not pasteurized. The vast majority of sauerkraut in the supermarket is pasteurized. Yes. It's dead. It's not a live culture.
Anything that's pasteurized is going to kill off those cultures.
Right.
And, you know, you could drink kefir. It's hard to find that not pasteurized unless you're finding a good source somewhere.
Right. But or you can make your own kefir. Make your own yogurt.
Make your own yogurt, exactly.
But make also, here's the new thing, and this is really helpful for people even with ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, and dairy allergies, and they want to get healthy cultures so they can't take yogurt or kefir, is the fermented coconut milk. That is now, and one of our patients just said she was able to find it at a big supermarket chain at Wegmans.
In Jersey.
It comes in fresh and refrigerated and not pasteurized, and it's a source of live cultures. And coconut is very healing to the gastrointestinal tract. So,
it is. So that's a wonderful. That's another. Eating some fermented food every day is always a good idea.
Right. And
along with taking probiotics and prebiotics, doing it all.
So you have way. When people come to see you, handouts and links to websites which specialize in this, and so we provide people with resources. And thank goodness for you, because man, it just takes a lot of time to educate and explain this kind of stuff to people. So I'm busy
and
on
fermented
the
fermented foods are making a comeback. They're becoming more and more popular.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing.
Yep. Yeah. Good. All right. So let's continue. We have time for an additional question for this segment.
Okay. We have, this comes to us from, again, I'm not finding a name here, but my husband and I love your podcast almost as much as we love dark chocolate.
All right.
Yeah. Well, here's a distressing thing. ConsumerLabs.com issued a report recently about purported lead and cadmium contamination in many cocoa products, including nibs and dark chocolate. So what do we do about that? How can we check this out ourselves? They've written to Consumer Labs and requested that they test more brands that health-conscious people use, not just your run-of-the-mill candy bar.
That's ConsumerLabs.com, right?
Yeah.
I didn't really see that article, but for our listening audience, ConsumerLabs.com is an outfit that tests products, natural products, vitamins, and now they're into the realm of dark chocolates, because the popularity of dark chocolate is sort of a functional food. And there is a possibility of contamination of some of these things. Now I like ConsumerLabs.com. The problem I have with them is that sometimes they've written articles that do a disservice to natural products, because their testing methodology is controversial. And just in fairness to them, it's actually very hard sometimes to test an herbal product, for example, for active ingredients. There are different methodologies that can be used. And sometimes they'll say a manufacturer doesn't have enough active ingredient when they're using a method of testing that is not sensitive enough to pick up the signature of this natural ingredient. So there's been some back and forth between the supplement industry and ConsumerLab.com about the accuracy of their testing. I presume it's easier to test for lead content. Also, ConsumerLab.com is, to some extent, it's free. They provide you with sort of a teaser of, here's the information. But if you want to delve deeper, it's a pay-to-play thing. You have to subscribe or you have to pay for a report. And they got to support their own business enterprise there too, because they're expending money and time and resources to gather this information. So it's sort of, they're positioning themselves to be the consumer reports of the vitamin supplement industry. The other critique of Consumer Lab is that they have a sort of a voluntary compliance program with supplement manufacturers who pay them to rate them. Now, Consumer Lab can, if your supplement isn't good, ConsumerLab.com isn't going to lie and say that your supplement is good or that it's free of contaminants. But there is an element of selectivity there where they'll say this and this product are good, but that's because the product manufacturer signed up with them to be rated. So it's truthful, but it's selective, and some of these methods can be
maybe
inaccuracy. I don't think they're picking favorites necessarily. So, I can't tell. I don't have independent ways of verifying this.
We have to also remember, we live in this world. It's pretty toxic. There is lead everywhere.
Yep.
If you live in an old building, the old pipes, the municipal water systems, when you turn on your laptop and you disconnect the battery, you're exposing yourself to lead. Cadmium is in the atmosphere, air pollutants, cigarette smoke, all of that. So, it's bound to wind up somewhere.
So I would say,
Most important thing is to make sure that a food or anything isn't overly contaminated, and to make sure that we're healthy and detoxifying properly.
Right. And also, many of our patients, we test them for lead levels. We look for blood levels. We also use a more sensitive test, which evaluates the presence of lead via a urine challenge test. And we think that's actually the best test to reveal the presence of lead. And then if there's a problem, we try to identify, A, you know, how's it getting into the body? But even if we can't identify that, it may be old lead. You know, people born, grew up in the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of lead that still was being used in gasoline and in paint before the stringent regulations came through. And your body retains lead, particularly it's stored in the bones. And we see surprising amounts of lead in some people, and then we offer them either oral chelation or intravenous chelation.
Yeah. And let's just talk about the reason for doing a urine test for this. When your doctor does a regular blood test to check for lead or mercury, they're not really going to see it there unless your levels are quite high that it's spilling over into your circulation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But most of these toxic metals, these heavy metals, are residing in places like bone, muscle, brain, and they need to be provoked out. That's why the urine testing we do is actually quite specific.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. So we have time for, do we have a quick question we can answer during this segment?
Yeah, we can. Okay, this comes from Tony in Toronto. How can I prevent kidney stones?
Oh, boy. I mean, he should just listen to my entire podcast on that subject.
Oh, great. You've got a clinical focus on it.
Clinical focus, yeah. Last week, if you go to drhoffman.com and go to the podcast and scroll down, I think it was just last week, oh my goodness, there's all these suggestions on how you can prevent kidney stones. And I actually didn't, this is not one that I wrote up, but it's an audio segment about 45, 50 minutes long. And, you know, first of all, you need an analysis of your kidney stones to find out if they're the most common type, which is oxalate stones, mm-hmm. Versus uric acid stones, because the different treatments for different types of stones. You need to hydrate, drink lots of water. If you have the most common type of stones, just a handy-dandy preventive is to use
Magnesium citrate,
along with B6, maybe 100 milligrams twice daily, but also just good old-fashioned lemon juice. Squeeze a half a cup of lemon juice. It may take several lemons to create that, and then dilute it with 7 cups of water. Maybe sweeten it with stevia, or maybe put just a little bit of sugar in there because it's very tart. Mm-hmm. And just guzzle that through the whole day. One. You have 7 cups a day, and that is a very good preventive. We have a whole host of tips in that audio, which I urge our friend in Toronto to access.
Terrific.
All
Tony,
right.
You should definitely go check it out.
Check it out. It's everything you need to know about kidney stones. All right. This is a logical break point, so when we return, we'll move on to part two of today's Q&A with Layla. And what do we have in store in part two?
How many supplements is too much? How much supplementation is too much?
Wow,
that's a big one.
That's an essay question. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll take that up in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Q&A with Layla, the Intelligent Medicine Podcast for today.